After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Buy that stuff for you. So, like, while to you it's meaningless, to them it's the time. I'm not saying you should, like, not I'm not saying about this, but it's like a general, like, life thing. I feel like that's like an interesting way that I've come to see, like, worthwhile look at things, even if you don't think they're monetarily worth a lot, which I think also reflects our perceptions of value, that the way we look at, like, a pencil and, like, a container, but also, like, the last hug you give your dying grandpa, we use the same words to describe all those things, and it's, like, value or price or priceless.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something I've remembered from, like, when I was growing up, like, something that I never understood the context for, because it's one of those things that happens when you're raising kids, right? You gotta say whatever to make them behave. And, like, when I would, like, not want to eat anything, there were two ways my mom would go about it. There was the one where she'd be like, hey, look, the farmer put some effort into this. I put some effort into cooking this. You know, be respectful and eat it is one way.
Yeah.
And that was usually what prompted me to be like, okay, I'll do something about it. And that's guilting, right? And then the other is, God's going to be angry with you if you don't do it.
Yeah.
And that made me want to do it less, but yeah, like...
I always got the, 'cause I said so, response.
Yeah, and here's the thing, 'cause, like, the first response was clearly to make me feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But in hindsight, I think there was some truth in that, where it's like, you should recognize...
You feel guilty because it's kind of true.
It's true. And that's what I'm getting at, is like, whether Marx is talking about the labor theory of value, where it's like, it's the work that you put into something that makes it valuable.
Yeah.
Or whether it's just like, understand... Because I think for me, the way I'm trying to look at everything now is like through social relations and social dynamics, right? And I'm probably misusing the terms. I've gotten everything. Okay. All my knowledge is really from osmosis at this point.
Words mean what we say they mean.
Right. And that's kind of like when you recognize how intricately people can be connected, when you realize how we're all bound together in ways that we initially don't recognize, or that things in ways we take for granted. It's humbling in a very good way.
Yeah.
You should be humbled by that, and you should recognize, you know, your obligations to other people.
In Japanese culture, before they eat, they say, you usually see them in anime, they, like, grab their chopsticks and, like, go, itadakimasu, which basically means, like, some version of, like, thank you for this meal. But it's, like, whenever there was, like, someone told me about it, and it was, like, they try and, like, imagine, at least this person did, they were, like, and I started doing it, like, imagine all the steps it took to get that, since I was in Japan, that sushi in front of you,
right.
Like, or whatever you're getting, like, the person who, and if you really go back far enough, like, it takes the entire world to get anything done.
Yeah.
Everyone that's ever lived. Mm-hmm. Like, imagine if something hadn't happened in African savannah 200,000 years ago, all of a sudden, you know, the mitochondrial Eve, she died before she could have a kid. We wouldn't have that sushi in front of you. Or you would be very different. And it's, like, really, which is why, like, a lot of people I've seen in, like, certain places, or I'm interested in, is a lot of, like, people are like, oh, they have Jeff Bezos, always, like, billionaires work for their money. But I'm like, Jeff Bezos, Amazon, they made money because of public roads, because of people, the public funding, because of, like, Rockefeller funding libraries, to even, like, the, you know, the Constitution being written by, you know, the biggest hypocrites in history. Like, it's this kind of, like, way of looking at it where, like, Jeff Bezos really just owes so much in debt that to even say anyone should make more than anyone else, I think, is, like, foolhardy at best. Like, you have to ignore, like, so much that goes into things. Mm-hmm. And, like, you really don't do anything on your own. Like, literally nothing you'll do from the day you die, the day you're born to the day you die, will be done alone. It's all done together. And I think, does that mean, I think it's one of those things, though, however, that I don't think it should be the basis inherently of, I think it should be a moral philosophy or a philosophical basis for a lot of our, legal movements and, like, legal traditions and how we choose to create our society, I guess. But it's one of those things I always think, it's like, it doesn't need to be the foundation, but some things are just important to keep in your mind. It's just, like, an important context to have to make sure it's there, but you can also choose to, like, put it aside a little bit, because it's like, do we have free will? Maybe, maybe not, but we kind of have to act like we have free will, because otherwise no one would ever be put in prison ever. No one would ever be punished for their act, because it's like, well, it's not really their free will. It's like Newton said this, or not Newton, Einstein, and I don't necessarily agree with this fully, but it's one of those things you have to consider. It's like, whether free will is real or not, we kind of have to act like there is free will.
What do you think of the idea of us all being part of a shared consciousness in that sense?
I think it's another one of those things where, is it true or not? I don't know. I don't know how to define consciousness. But I do think it's an important thing that has at least... It's just not truthful. It's tangential to truth to an important way. Where it's, you know, I don't know if it's real, but I definitely know that, like, your friends have a connection. The people you love have a connection with you, and there's no physical connection. I mean, apart from, like, you know, if you count the air we breathe and carbon dioxide, that kind of, like, cycle in a way, you could view it as, like, me, the tree, and you have a bond, where, like, that tree is an interlocutor between us sharing breaths, if you will. But I think that, like, yeah, it's an important thing to consider, because it just reflects the way we act. It's like the God thing, where, like, whether there's a God or not, I think, like, there's reasons people who are religious are actually really nice people, and some are awful. It's because of how they chosen to use that, like, interlocutor of God as a reason for doing something. Whether it's true or not, it's how they choose to go about it. And I think my issue with religion is that it's too arbitrary. It doesn't actually reflect any sense of, like, having to be real or not. You can make it all up. Whereas a shared consciousness, we kind of know what we're all talking about, whether you're from a rural town in, like, Iowa, or whether you're from Shanghai, or whether you're from, you know, Accra and Ghana. Like, we kind of, if you were to say that in the languages translated, we would kind of all get it, I think.
So welcome back to the greenhouse, dear listeners. Sorry for the more mystic tone. I'm not really sorry. I'm joined by old friend Tom. We don't have an outline for this one. We are quite honestly just drinking tea, talking about life, whatever comes to us. Just letting the mind palaces run amok, as they say.
I don't know who says it, but I like it. I like that saying.
I don't know. I'm vibing today.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. It's a good one. Good sayings, dude. I was thinking about this a while ago. I was like, man, like, I was talking to my therapist, and it was just like a certain phrases he'll say, and I'm like, dude, that should be tattooed everywhere. It's just like that. That should be on every poster. And sometimes I don't even think of it off the top of my head, but there's just certain things some people say where, like, okay, can we take a second to realize that, like, that was like 10 syllables of just, like, straight truth.
So I'm feeling like a wave right now, right? And I'm just trying to think, like, how certain is everything? Like, do you think there are absolute truths?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. So I could go two ways with this. I could be kind of a meme-y douche and be like, well, I don't think so, but I'm absolutely true that I don't think so. You could argue that, like, one way or another, either is, or the only absolute truth, it's like cognito sum, I think therefore right. I am. It's like, kind of like the only absolute truth is that there's not absolute truth.
Right, and I think, let me try to clarify my question, I guess, because this is just something that's been in the background of every episode I've been recording now at this point. And with this being the 30th episode, maybe it's time I just get to the point of this, is like, when things get communicated, right, there's like there's a loss of fidelity of the message. And my personal insecurities that come up from, like, whether it's, like, my life experience or whether this is just paranoia on my part, I kind of feel like there's more desperation in communication than we, you know, take for granted. And when we're trying to communicate, there's, like, this fear of the message not fully getting there. And that can be sometimes expressed as hostility, that can sometimes be expressed as insecurity, what have you. And what's been great about our discussions, you know, as long as we've known each other, is that your background in linguistics has actually helped answer some of this stuff. And I wanted to ask, like, is communication really limited? Or can it be limited by the fact that we all have such different experiences every day?
So I think there's a few things that just, like, pops in my mind. One, it's something that's actually really interesting about, like, so I've dated linguistically, I'll say.
Right.
Even if we're, you know, some people from the same culture or different languages, like some people who are, you could argue interlinguistically, when I've dated people who were, like, say, we both know someone I dated that was black, and, like, that could, you could consider, like, a way interlinguistic kind of discussion, just because we come from certain backgrounds that, like, that kind of to the point where like each person has their own personal language, but something with like actual, like when I dated someone and I was speaking Japanese the whole time, you are so much more open because there's an assumption that like, which should be there, I think, in general.
Right.
Because language is such an imprecise tool, as much as I love it, that ultimately you don't really ever know what they're saying. And when you have that priming of like, oh, it's a foreign language. Like sometimes someone in Japan, she might speak English when I was a speaker girl I'm thinking of, and she might say something, I'm like, oh, that's a bit mean. But then she literally just didn't know any other way to say it. And then she known like the more nuanced way to kind of get the point across, then she didn't mean it. But because I was like, oh, she maybe just didn't know, I then asked the question and we had the discussion and it was not a big deal at all. And it actually made us closer because that like we had the assumption of not quite knowing what was going to be said. Whereas mm-hmm. the thing about in your own culture, and I think part of the reason why foreigners in America, for example, especially these people who speak a foreign language, scare so many people on a deep level is because they feel like that's a barrier to connection they can't have
mm-hmm.
and they don't know what's being said. But like I, you know, I'm learning Spanish now and I'll hear people speaking Spanish and someone will be like, oh, what are they saying? And I'm like, they're talking about the weather and like how, the rainy day they had like a soccer game yesterday. And you wouldn't know, just normal conversations, but there's that barrier. So I think ultimately it's like, it's learning to find the joy and being like, look, I might not know anything you're saying. And if you come in with that perspective, no, you might not be able to fully get your point across. But I think deep down, we all kind of get it. Like, if I talk about love,
mm-hmm.
say between friends or romantic, I might not be able to describe that fully, but I can get close enough. We kind of have a shared feeling. But at the same time, there is some ways that fail. For example, I'm colorblind, a red green colorblind, and like, I can never know that my red is the same red as yours.
Mm.
Like, we can both think that's red, but literally to me, the red I'm seeing now could be for you a purple. Just, we have no idea. What's more likely to happen because of red colorblindness, you see a purple, I probably just see blue because reds usually get drained from things. When I see them, I usually get like pink will look white, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll call something white and you'll call it pink.
Right.
We'll call something pink because I've just associated that with pink. But what we're actually seeing, if you saw my eyes, you would call that thing white. It was a bit convoluted, but it's just kind of like...
It makes sense because this is a hard idea to get across. And which I was is
a meta commentary on this whole conversation that we can't convey this with language.
But, right. Yeah. And that's the crazy part because when I was trying to ask the question, I'm like, I sound like I'm on too many drugs right now.
Yeah. Which usually sometimes helps. Sometimes helps with the questioning.
I guess.
Because you lose away some of the pretense.
Well, I mean, because we're both looking for the viewer, or sorry, for the listener, we are both looking at a red object right now.
Mm-hmm.
And like I guess let me try to test the concept right now, right? So it's like, what is the color you're seeing right now when I'm looking at this?
It's like a pinkish red in the inside, where it's like a red but there's like hues of pink in it.
Mm.
But also one thing I've as a side little note that's really funny that I've because I got those in chromia glasses that right, are like right. colorblind glasses. I didn't end up keeping them because like I said, I'm not like people are colorblind, they think, can't see any color. Mm-hmm. I can see color. It's just like, you know, I couldn't join the military, for example, because gotcha. If there's like smoke signals, I would miss them potentially or like things like that. Side note, fun fact, some people with certain types of colorblindness are actually asked to be snipers because they can see ghillie suits better, which is a side note that's kind of interesting because the way they see greens, it actually shows up ghillie suits more.
Shit.
But, which is this whole side thing. But... which I think is true. It might not be. Who knows?
I'm going to have to let my CIA handler know.
But yeah. So but the thing that's like that is like describe red without using other colors. And that's a poet's job, basically. But
I guess, yeah.
Because that the poet's job. It's like someone was in one of these videos I saw, to get back to the point, is they asked a question. They went, is this purple? About like a pen. Mm-hmm. Like, is this purple? Because they would take off the glasses because purple, maybe they would see like purple is like a type of brown, like... Everyone's different, right?
Right.
Like, even my grandpa who had it, or my cousin who has it, we might have different variations of that same colorblindness, but it's like, is this purple? And how do you describe a color without using other colors? If I can't see colors, you literally can't describe a color to me.
Right.
You can describe how it makes you feel. You can describe... It's like pain. You can describe how it feels, but can you really describe what you're feeling when you're in pain? You can get close. You can try.
Can you rank it from a 1 to a 10? Dear God, yeah. How could you? But... There is a linguistic phenomenon of this, right? Where in Japanese, isn't aoi used for green and blue?
Yeah. Basically. Yes, it's basically true. There's like slight nuance to it, but that it works for this discussion. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Or they'll use it for like a blue. Yeah, there's like a, or there's what more importantly is like the barrier between blue and green, where we call blue, blue and green, something like blue, green versus green, blue.
Mm.
For them, it's shifted where that barrier is at.
Got you.
So it's like when something becomes blue as opposed to like a base blue with some green in it or a base green with some blue in it. That is shifted.
It's like teal versus
sun. Yeah, and they also have a word for, yeah, for exactly. And they have a word for watercolor. Like something is the color of water.
Mm.
Like that's a word that they use.
That's true.
If I'm not mistaken. That might not be water, but it's one of the, like, it's certain, one of those, like, core base elements where it's like, they'll use a fire color. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I think it's watercolor where it's like, that's actually a way you can describe something. And that's what's really cool about, the thing about common sense, people forget the word common. It requires you have something in common with the people you're making sense with.
That's true.
Move to a foreign culture and all of a sudden what, like, you know, what you should do if you have an issue with your neighbor, for example. In Japan, the first thing they talk to you is call the police. You don't talk to them, you call the police.
Shh.
It's because in Japan, it's based off of, like, a hierarchy of power. You get someone who has power over you. It's still obviously changing, it's a modernizing society, yeah. But, like, traditionally, and things like this, it still is ingrained to some degree, where, like, I have an example of this, but basically, like, I had an issue with, like, trash. Like, you have to separate your trash more there, and I had done it wrong a few times because, you know, I was in a foreign country and I messed it up. And this guy took pictures of it for months of all this foreign trash. And he sent it to my school and had the school. He didn't tell me for 7 months he was taking pictures. He didn't tell me once. I have no idea who the guy is. And I was like, and they're like, yeah, it's totally normal. And my school had to tell me. And I was like, it was a bit of racism because more than half the pictures weren't even me. He just assumed the white, because some of my neighbors were also foreigners, but they had like darker hair and darker features. One of them
was, got you.
But they literally just assumed all the mess of trash was the blonde haired white guy. Like, because for pretext, I have very white blonde hair. Like, imagine a Swedish person, basically. And so they assumed it was me, and how he dealt with it was not talk to me, not be like, hey, do you have issues with your trash? One time it was me, but I was leaving the country for to go back here for 10 days, and it was the summer in Japan. Summer's like, it's 95 degrees and 95% humidity. It's hot, and it was my food. So I would have had tons of bugs and insects and tons of issues, so I threw it out early.
Right.
And so we never had the discussion. I'm like, hey, can you hold on to this for me and throw it out? There was not that. That was not part of it. But to every Japanese I talked to, they were like, yeah, that's what you should do. That was common sense.
Mm-hmm.
But to us, they're like, that's ridiculous. But to them, it's just common sense. And I think it all goes back to the point of, like, it's not whether or not, I don't think the question should be, is, I think it's an important question, but I think the deeper one maybe to get to that actually circumscribes our life is, like, what do you do with the reality that we can never really understand each other?
That's, I think, the question I was trying to ask is, like, how do you reconcile that fact? Do you even? Also, sorry if there were shifting noises. My foot is fucking asleep right now. We have, like, a really boho setup right now. I'm sitting on the floor, and I don't know, my fat ass thought I could still sit. Crisscross applesauce. It happens. How are you looking at the tea?
It's beautiful.
I'm worried it's a little too smoky, but that's okay.
It's very nice. It's very good. It's like it's one of those fall days where, like, I would take cold tea or warm tea.
Gotcha.
It's like, it's a type of, like, ray that anything, even just blackness or the light, would, like, help. Just any difference from, like, the gray in all directions, I feel like. And I feel like that's what the tea does for, like, my, I don't know, soul. I don't know.
It's definitely a lot less stress on the system than coffee.
Oh, yeah. I think tea, like, disperses. It has less caffeine in general. Most tea. Maybe black tea doesn't.
I think it's the time you brew it that affects the caffeine content. Don't cite me. No one cite me on that.
Well, I definitely think the different types of teas. And then I know, I do know that matcha has different caffeine content. Mm-hmm. I think it has more than the rest of the teas. But I think it has, the time you brew it has to do with, because obviously if it's seeped for a minute versus 10, like, you're just going to get more. And then I think also the type of tea as well. But I just feel like, at least for me, when I have tea, the caffeine hits way, it's more of a mellowed out, long, elongated, whereas coffee, when it hits, it, like, it hits.
Until it doesn't.
Yeah, well, that's when the next glass is immediately, right. Like, drank, and you just have that hit again. That's kind of the whole thing. It's, you never come down from the high of coffee, because when it happens, it's over.
Oh, my God. I'm trying to, there must have been a time, I think this was, like, when I was living in New Orleans, and my job had one of those, like, shit coffee pots that, like, it's just burnt water and it's just caffeine straight to the veins. It's what fuels the corporate world, is that kind of battery acid coffee. No complaints about it, just saying.
You can complain, it's okay.
Yeah, we should all complain about it, but it's, I must have had, like, 4 to 6 cups of coffee a day, and it just hit a point where I think my body gave up, and I had, like, functioning diarrhea for like a month.
Yeah. You know what's wild about...
Like, we expect people to be very unhealthy to be productive.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think it's part of the reason why, like, dental isn't covered in health insurance, because it won't stop you from working.
Yeah, you have to fucking take a day off to go to the dentist or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they, well, it's not covered. It's like dental's an added bonus to the healthcare you already don't really get here. But what's really wild about coffee, I thought about, it's another capitalist running itself into the ground. Capitalism relies on coffee in this this kind of, like, you know, not really, but like totally kind of does it in the sense of like that kind of mentality. But capitalism and climate change is actually destroying a lot of the regions that coffee can grow in. So eventually we're going to have a coffee shortage from capitalism.
God.
It's like it's going full circle here. We're going to have that coffee shortage because of that.
Oh, God. I mean, when Marx was talking about, you know, capitalism engineers the means of its own destruction, he was speaking in more ways than one.
Yeah, yeah. And what Zizek said,
he's, to quote Marx, he was more correct than he knew.
Yeah, which is, it's always beautiful when, I think that's really, though, just like paying attention to things, though. Like, I think things are always more correct or incorrect the more attention you pay to them. Because I think it's just like, the more, it's like if you drink a lot of tea, you can notice the minutiae of the tea or the coffee. Like, you know, I couldn't tell you, honestly, much difference between black coffee or decaf at all. I don't drink coffee at all. I have ADHD. It is not a good combo. Mm-hmm. So I literally couldn't tell you what the difference is, besides maybe the color. And you could tell the difference because you have more exposure, and basically you've put more attention into coffee.
Gotcha.
And I wonder what would happen in life if we just did that to our, like, friends and family and, like, loved ones and just people we care about in the environment. If we just, like, put more, like, all attention to see how right they really were, and how, like, wonder how much depth can be found within something. How it's like, it's like Noam Chomsky, who's obviously a famous anarchist, as you probably know, but also, like, one of the most famous linguists ever. He basically put the theory out that, like, from a set number of words, you can have an infinite number of combinations in a language,
mm-hmm.
which is basically what I feel like people are. We're a set number of words in a way. We're just this one form, but to me, we're infinitely deep.
That's another point in the box for shared consciousness theory, I guess. I don't even know what to make of it. It's one of those concepts that brings relief and anxiety all at once to me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, like, there's a cold relief in that. That, like, maybe I'm not as different from everyone. But maybe that just means I'm really paranoid about not being the same. Who knows?
Do you feel like it's really interesting that, like, both being the same as everyone and being different both makes you stressed and relieved? Like, relieved?
I think for me, that intensifies the contradiction. It took me a minute to remember the word contradiction there. It intensifies the contradiction of how unequal everyone is then. Because we have certain common ideas of good behavior. We have certain common ideas of justice and equality and all this stuff. Even if it's not true in our societies, growing up in the Western liberal tradition means you're exposed to it in some sense. It becomes part of your assumptions in some sense, right? Maybe I'm wrong about how we come to those conclusions. Maybe my pet concept of greenhouse gaslighting could be wrong. But I kind of believe that we hold on to those assumptions a lot more closely than we admit at times, or even that we're aware of at times. But if we all do share, like, a shared consciousness, then that means we're in a state of perpetual cognitive dissonance. We are physically maintaining that contradiction of inequality, of hierarchy, of oppression globally. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Do you think it also provides a solution, though?
It should. And I think that's the relief and anxiety part of it. And that should be the... I don't like the term leftist. I think it's just been bastardized because of online shit, but...
Yeah, it's racist to right-handed people, I agree.
It's handist. But what I do think is, if you're in favor of making things better, or you believe that there's something better than what we're living with right now, to some extent you have to want to resolve the contradictions. Mm-hmm. And I don't see... I don't see why we can't all agree, I guess. And maybe that's the problem, is like you can't reason people into it. They have to feel it.
I think that, though, is the exact way. I think that last thing about that feeling is that I think deep down we all kind of get it. Like, I don't know how to describe what it is, but I kind of think everyone knows who it is.
You feel bad. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You feel bad.
And like, you're like, yeah, like, I think we all want to be loved and to love. And, yeah, we all have in-group, out-group, and we have some innate, you know, barriers as humans. But I think we're innately viewing in-group and out-group, yes, but who is that in-group and out-group is not innate. It's not predetermined in us. And
it's pretty random.
Who we choose to love and how we choose to love them. And I think that's something, like, for example, like I said about Japan thing, I didn't care. I mean, I liked anime before in Japan, and I was interested in Buddhism and other things too. But now, like, when someone makes a statistic about Japan, about suicides, for me, it's like you're talking about my former students. You know, people I really care deeply about, like, people I still talk to. Kids who, like, you know, I saw them as they were missing days because of mental health, and people are like, oh, Japan has so many issues, and I'm like, using that as a fun fact, to me, that's like, these are real people, and it's not like I was born that way. I mean, one of the more interesting things that occurrences that happened was, like, I was teaching children whose, my grandpa fought Japan in World War II. Our grandparents might have fought each other, literally to kill each other, and now I'm helping to teach, or I'm going, being friends with their grandchildren, and so there's nothing innate in it, but it's how we choose to go about it, and I think it's that thing deep, but we just kind of get it, and we feel it, and I think, like, disasters kind of showcase this, where, like, when stuff goes wrong, the country's the most united during disasters, Katrina, 9/11, and, you know, we definitely have issues, and they come out very quickly oftentimes, but I think the fact that, like, you know, we all, at the end of the day, like, even if we, like, remember, like, we want to do good, even if our question should be, what is good? But I think deep down, like, I think Hitler thought he was doing good. Now, did he do good? No. But I think he had that desire to do some type of his concept of goodness, and I think that inclination that every person has, in goodness might be called love, it might be called just connection, whatever you want. Again, I think language is failing more than, like, anything else in my perspective, which also I think circumscribes my ability to even think about it, because then you have to think about it through pure feeling, because I can't describe it in my head, but I kind of know what I want to say, which I think gets back to issues of language, but also, like, the solution to consciousness is, I think, when we see a baby, like, smiling, I think most of us smile, and I don't think that's a coincidence. And I think it's finding that root and trying to extrapolate that and centralizing our economic systems, our legal systems, our sociopolitical and hierarchical systems, in centering it in that, as opposed to what our modern version is, which is capital and capitalism.
Right.
Or what was feudalism, or whatever ism, whatever, you know, it's not, capitalism still nuking the block, but centralizing that sharedness, you know, that I'm one person in 7 billion, and that, like, it helps me in my poetry, for example, is that, like, I'm like, look, this idea I've had is not original. I'm just but I'm, my life I'm living is original, so how do I coalesce that intensely unoriginality with my original existence? And I think if we can appreciate that, like, nah, like, my culture is not, every culture is unique, but no culture is uniquely unique. And, like, appreciating that I'm unique as a person, but I'm not uniquely unique, so let me just, like, I'm on an even playing field, let me just appreciate, like, this food I've never eaten, or this person I've never really kind of experienced, and learn to love that process, and understand that it's a process. I think that can maybe not solve it, but I think it can get us towards a better direction, at least. And helps solve that cognitive dissonance as well.
Yeah, I guess trying to accept the randomness of how those differences come about. I guess that's, yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, we are just apes, you know? We're just monkeys, you know?
I think we should return to monkey. Like, I'm not really on that anarcho-primitivist track, but we should return to monkey. 100%.
That'd be a great album cover for, like, a return, like, album after, like, 20 years, like, from some band called Return to Monkey. Or a great movie, like, Volume 2 of a movie cycle called Return to Monkey.
Planet of the Apes, Return to Monkey.
That'd be a great one. I would watch that. But, yeah, I think also the asking, like, the thing about questions that's wonderful is, like, the best questions don't try and answer anything, but they just, like, they're almost, like, you're looking through a tiny keyhole, and then all of a sudden the door's been opened, and you still have, you now there's like, wow, there's way more light, but the door, but like the question, I don't know how to explain it, it's a terrible metaphor, but basically it's like, a good question doesn't try to answer anything, but it's such a good question, and you, the person who you're like asking it to, just answers things for themselves in that questioning. Which is when you think of good teachers, or like a therapist, or just like an art, a movie you watched, or a song you listened to, where it's like, damn, they asked me a question that like, they didn't tell me what the answer is, but just the process of the asking moved me forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's I think central to a lot of this too, this cognitive dissonance, that like when you feel comfortable and uncomfortable, it's you've asked a question that's answered some things, so you're comfort in some ways, but now you just have more questions. And I think it's learning to love asking questions and being asked questions that I think, and asking them with love and with like compassion and like care.
An innocent curiosity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's really what we miss about childhood too.
Childhood.
But I think it's like, it's that innocent curiosity. Just like, I really am just like the question, is this purple? Like, it's just such a pure question. It's like that person, that moment went back to childhood innocence of like, what's purple? And meant it. And I think that's what we kind of in many ways seek. But like, it's like trying to be humble. If you try to be humble, you'll never be humble. If you try to be cool, you'll never be cool. It's like when you stop caring about being cool or being humble, that's when you can start to be humble.
Yeah, you can't impose it on yourself. You have to feel it in some sense.
And I think you just asking the questions, living life. There's a quote. I forgot who said it, but the thing about happiness is the second you wonder whether or not you are, you cease to be. And I think it's just like letting it be, and that's like our endeavor. That's our task, is like 46 chromosomed how as we are, like that's, or you know, 47 to everyone, obviously respect to everybody, but like, you know, the general thing of this is our human endeavors. We ask questions,
right?
You know, Homo sapiens, but we know ourselves. But I would argue that's actually like a wish to call ourselves Homo sapiens, because we spend our whole lives trying to know ourselves,
right? This is definitely more of a Joe Rogan experience style episode. We just went straight into it, but that answers my question strangely. I think all of that has answered a question I've been having pretty much all year. So
I'm glad. I feel like, I don't know. I just feel like the cool thing about a podcast like this is it creates a platform. It's a type of performance, but it's a third thing where we can kind of, like, we need interlocutors. There was, like, a thing that came out where, like, studies have shown that, like, most relationships, you look at a third thing, which is an issue with Zoom and for being in COVID, is we staring each other in the eyes, which usually is not how you talk to people. Usually you're playing a video game, or you're going shopping together, or you're looking at a tree. Like, there's some third, or you're talking about someone. There's some third thing, and a podcast is really interesting because it's almost like the third thing is the performance.
It's the performance, and also I think, because I came into this, you know, I listened to podcasts for many years before I had the idea of, like, maybe I should try this. And I think, I don't know what clicked in, where, like, I stopped listening to music on my phone, and I was like, let me listen to, like, a video essay or a speech or whatever. And then this idea of, you can abstract away this idea of a conversation with people, pull it out of the timeline, and then turn it into a file that someone can listen to. It's interesting. It's very interesting. That
cool way of putting it.
Yeah, I'm not sure how else to explain it, because I think I've talked to you about, like, Matt Crispin from Chapo. He does this very excellent vlog series, and he's just fleshing out these ideas that are just, like, very high level. But because of how poorly read I am, I'm kind of metabolizing ideas different ways. So, one, I need to catch up on my theory.
Stop. You're as poorly well or as well read as you choose to let yourself define as.
I think I could do better. But when he talks about, like, abstracted mental activity, that's kind of, I need to come up with a better way of defining this process.
Do you feel like Socrates or Plato's dialogues, like, back 2,000 years ago, where he just wrote a book, or was it Republic? We wrote a book of people's conversations, was, like, the original podcast. It was the original transcript for a podcast.
Could have been. could have been, you know, what I mean,
like a conversation.
But that's what I'm talking about. So, like, yeah. Using that as an example, it's because I'm gonna struggle to find the words. So I'm gonna use your example as the intermediary. Him transcribing that conversation from two people who are not him is an abstraction away from the physical world. Do you get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You're taking information and turning it into something else. And to do that, you have to abstract it. Maybe abstract is even the wrong word I'm picking. But you get the idea of what I'm trying to convey here. Mm-hmm. Which this brings us back full circle to the question I asked at the start, right? But
We're gonna go back there the whole time.
Oh, this is going to be the entire theme, right? But when you do that, you introduce this kind of entropy in the system of how human society then works. Because you go away from it where we live fully in the physical world, and then we start to have a life of the mind in this very weird way, right? And I might even be misusing the term, so correct me if I'm wrong. But when you do that with, let's say, like a podcast, right? It has this interesting effect of creating the parasocial relationship, right? Where me as a fully alienated person from this situation gets to feel like I'm watching a conversation happen in front of me, or I'm hearing a conversation around me.
Do you ever stop the podcast and, like, respond in how, if you were there?
That's the thing. Sometimes I do. And
because I definitely have done that before. I've done this to this podcast before. Where I was like, I stopped it. I was like, here's what I would say. And then Ryan or someone was like, oh, they covered it. Cool.
Or just like, or even like, I wouldn't pause. I'd be like, oh my God, these guys are hilarious or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When I was living alone, I was really into podcasts because it was filling that social void I needed to meet of meeting and talking to people. And podcasts like Chapo, like, filled in that gap for me. And I learned a lot through osmosis from podcasts because people are talking about their experiences. Like, it's very crazy how much you can learn about individual people and, or at least come up with your idea of how they must be from just an abstracted conversation that they have. And the more they do it, the more you feel like you know the person, which I guess is fandom in general. But in a podcast, it explicitly can do that.
Just all relationships that you'll ever have with anyone.
But that's the thing about the parasocial relationship, because you're fully abstracted from these people. It kind of creates this weird, like, it's a way of relating to people that I don't think humans have a capacity for yet.
I think there actually is.
I get what you're saying, that it's not inherently bad.
Not necessarily that, actually. I think you are kind of going, like, you think, like, it's like you're in, I'm even balancing this, maybe as I'm hearing it, is what you're saying is, like, you're in your plane and you're trying to hop into their plane. But, like, when we're having a discussion, I'm, like, vaguely aware that people might listen to this. And so, like, to me, that's a plane that's involved in this conversation right now.
Right.
That, like, I'm aware they're there. So it's not just, it's almost like, what's the circle thing where you have, like, the two circles and what's in the middle of the Venn diagram, or whatever it's called, that you, like, draw stuff. Like, there's a, it's not just two circles and they're trying to hop into one. Like, we're kind of both meeting in the middle a bit of this kind of parasocial, like, relationship where it's, like, I'm aware that people are listening. So, like, when I'm talking now, like, I'm conscious, like, of my speed of
voice. I'm trying to share.
Yeah, so it's, like, maybe I don't know the person exactly, but just like, they're imagining me, or you're imagining people who listen to the podcast, but I'm also imagining them.
Right.
And so in that that shared imagination, perhaps there is an actual social reality that's there. And, like, imagine going to, like, a rally for Bernie Sanders. Like, he's not talking to me. But there's a sense of, like, there's some third space in between, even if it's the shared consciousness, where we're aware there's a shared space of consciousness that we're inhabiting, and there is a conversation here. There's a theory in, like literature and art, where there's, like, a triangle. You have, on the top, you have, like, the work. On the left, you have the artist, and on the right, you have the reader. And each, there's three relationships there. There's the artist to their work, the work to the listener, to the reader, and then the reader to the actual writer. And
there's nine relationships total, basically.
My math is gonna fail me, but, like,
I'm gonna assume there are.
Yeah, but basically, it's like there's different relationships, and, like, the relationship they have to the work is a material of me. Like, I don't matter for part of that relationship, And the only way I matter is their imagined version of me. But yet it's still a real relationship. It still matters, and you can count this podcast as the work. And I think as much as like a nonfiction or fiction thing is a reflection of me, this podcast is also a degree of performance where it's like, this also isn't the total real me. So we're both meeting in some space, I think.
We're aware the discussion's going to end. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're aware that at some point, like, I got to go. And it's not just like, oh, hey, like, let me just, like, grab my keys and run back in. Like, it's going to end at a... In a way, it's in unnatural in some sense. That's... We're all in some unnatural space and in that sense, but we're all natural beings in that space. So we're kind of... We're basically bringing something to life. We're Frankensteining something almost in a way.
Right.
It's like, but the shared consciousness is our way of doing it, I think. I don't know if there was a point to that, but...
You know, there doesn't have to be a point for everything, but what that's making me feel is that there might be a necessity, maybe even a duty at times, to recognize human communication and human connection as something sacred and something that should be valued and treasured. Mm-hmm. It should force us, or it should compel us, to treat one another with more compassion, dignity, kindness, that stuff. In that sense, then.
It's why I like the quiet people, when they don't speak often, everyone listens. Because it's almost like this is a sacred thing, the quiet dude speaking or the quiet girl speaking, and it's like, oh, you know what I mean? Like, because those words, if you count, like, you know, how much weight a person who speaks a lot as someone who speaks a lot, like, I've definitely had this thought where I'm like, man, I wish I just was the quiet dude. Who just said, when I spoke, everyone listened. Because each syllable I say, each breath I take, means more in a way. Because the people know around me, he doesn't speak often, so if he's speaking, it's important.
And is that like why we might resent people who speak too much? Because they're basically assuming they're communicating their own existence as a priority. And it makes us feel undervalued in some way. Or maybe they do undervalue us in some way. Yeah. I'm spitting. Yeah. I'm not trying to
start treating anyone with this. I actually think some of it has to do with, like, there's a quote by Kaveh Akbar, I think it's how I pronounce his name, who in a poem he says, I have always used words to try and tell the world that I'm worth something. Mm. And so I think it's more, not that they don't value, but that the same way like a bully bullies, not saying they're trying to bully, but a bully bullies you, the person, not because they care about the person, but it's about themselves. Like, when I'm speaking more, it's because I'm feeling uncomfortable and invalued, even if I'm not actually valued in a situation.
Right.
So I feel like I have to prove myself. Whereas I think that's what it produced for me, has been maybe jealous of people quiet, because in my mind, I'm like, if you're quiet, you must be so comfy and feel so valued. And maybe they're thinking the opposite, like, oh, I wish I could speak more, and they're really shy, and that's, you know, we imagine each other even through our own lenses of, like, what we think, and we might wish we were each other. Mm-hmm. And so the goal really is just to appreciate who we are, but... Yeah, I think that's maybe like why what made Trump so abhorrent in some deep way to a lot of people is that he seemed to not value the words. He seemed to just throw things around, not really caring
at all. And that may be like another thing about, because this is not a grand fucking theory I have about politics, or I don't have anything meaningful to say about Trump. There's been too much shit that's
been said. No one's ever said anything about Trump before.
But I think it's like, because we associate certain things, like the office of the President of the United States, with such moral and social worth, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then we assume, or at least I grew up assuming, that when someone comes to give a speech, it must be important, so you pay attention. Granted, that was probably my parents trying to, you know, get me to behave, or maybe that's something I did believe as a kid that I carried forward. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But... we assume the president coming to make a speech is something special, and that's why, like, there's a lot of hay made about Obama's oratory skills, or, you know, like, was he sincere behind his rhetoric? Was he insincere? What was it that people found charismatic about what he said? You know, even though, and especially, like, for us as people who are very critical of his legacy, right? Mm-hmm. That becomes an especially charged topic, right? And then for people who have a buy-in with the system, or for people who imbue things like the office of the president with those kind of values, to have a guy like Trump with his perceived and true vulgarities creates a contradiction of how they perceive the office. And there's the way I reacted to it, which is, well, that means the office of the president means jack shit. And then there's the way they respond to it, which is, how dare he get the office? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that just makes me think of a line by the new Clint Smith book. The title, I haven't read it. It's called How the Word is Passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, like, yeah, like, the office of the president is
and maybe it's not even the office. Maybe it's just, like, the decorum we associate with our institutions.
And it's also because we then feel, I don't know if responsible is the right word, but certainly a connection. Even if you hate, even if you despise the U.S. government, everything it stands for.
Right.
If you're an American, it still in some way represents you, or for most Americans, that, like, they put themselves in that. Even if they'll never be president, that person needs to stand for them in some way. You know what I mean? Like, I think, like, when I was abroad and when I was in Europe, when Obama was president, it was very different the way whether or not I would even say I was American. Like, I would not, when Trump became president, especially because I inhabited liberals, more leftist circles, and Europe is just, generally speaking, more leftist, you didn't, unless you really asked me, I wasn't telling you I was American. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was in France, I was speaking French, and I have a pretty good accent, so I was not letting on people know that I was American, and it was just because it made life easier. Whereas Obama was president, even one dude literally told me from Argentina, he was like, yeah, I'm chill with talking to you now because Obama's president, not Bush anymore. He literally told me that. And I was like, wow, like, it does have an effect. And so I think the fact that, like, people will perceive us, and I think even most Americans still have no connection with the outside world, outside of America, but they know that people perceive Americans.
And I think, I don't want to, like, derail your train here, but what's funny about all that too is then it turns into the perception of an individual person's decorum instead of our actual actions abroad or our foreign policy. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And we can get off the politics train anytime, but it's funny that
hashtag privilege.
it's funny that you mentioned, like, the guy about Bush is like, what was it that people resent about Bush? Was it the fact that, like, he was doddering at times? Or was it the fact that, like, he was presiding over a very monstrous conflict that we didn't need to get into?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I feel like a lot of the loudest noises made about Trump came from the people who solely objected about his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And less about what he was enabling the American state to get away with, the different kinds of policies he wanted to enact. And
do you think it's because of the tangibility of those two things? We can metaphorically feel or touch and understand this is a personality.
I guess, yeah, it's easier to get people to maybe accept that that's not acceptable behavior for someone in that position, more than it is to get someone to accept, like,
tax policy.
Not even just tax policy, but even stuff like, when you have that much power, regardless of whether you think it's right or not that someone has that much power, you would hope they are responsible enough to exercise it responsibly, or to exercise it justly. And I don't think
that's hard to wrap your mind around. Then, like, that dude's a dick. Like, you know what I mean? I think
on a very basic level, you could synthesize the two in theory. Yeah. It's like, wow, he's a dick and he's, like, irresponsible with that level of power. I hope people can reconcile the two, but
yeah. Well, I think the thing about symbols is that, especially broad symbols, or words that have broad meaning, the word racism to me has no functional purpose. People can talk about the academic definition about structural inequalities, blah, 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 but words are function to create connection between people, and racism doesn't do its job as a word. It has so many different meanings, but that's a slight tangent. But it's the same thing about nations or ideas or, like, idols, is that, like, it when you have an idol like the United States, this broad concept, you can apply whatever you want to it, which is why mm-hmm. some people are so easy to say you're not American, because the way they've conceived of America doesn't reflect whatever. Or in it's so Trump, I think, filled that role too, or the presidency, where it's like these vast things that are symbols don't. It can mean anything to anyone, and so like that's why it matters, because you in some way, even if you are opposed to, I think, the presidency, you're still in some way juxtaposing your sense of identity by this lightning rod point that is like the presidency.
And that's what I wish there was more discussion about, or at least if there are people discussing this kind of stuff, I want to get into that kind of stuff. It's like, how do these symbols arise? How do they get imbued with this kind of meaning? How and why are the ways in which they get imbued with meaning so starkly differently among peoples or groups or polities that it can create conflict? Like, where does that come from, and how does that process like get reconciled?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the question of shared consciousness. It's one of the few places where, if consciousness, let's say consciousness is attention,
right,
when you have the ability to pay attention, there's one of the few places where everyone's attention's at to some degree. Or if you're not putting your attention there, it's still a thing that we agree is a choice you're making. Like, I'm not paying attention to the underground 70s, I don't know, rock scene in Bangladesh, if there even is one. It's just not a thing my attention would go to. It's not something I have to say I agree with or disagree with or put my attention to or not. It's just not a thing in my consciousness. Whereas everyone,
now I want to look it up.
Yeah, it would be cool. I hope it's awesome. I think wasn't that when the Civil War was, though, with Pakistan? That would be, if they do have movies from then, that must be incredible.
Right.
If it's from that period. But like, yeah, like it's this idea of like, that's why this thing means so much, and why it causes so much conflict, because it's one of the few points where we can all have a say. It's like when I was in Japan, all of the Japanese people's favorite countries were like Western countries, and their favorite countries were like China and Korea. And because they had so many stereotypes about China and Korea, because they had so much more intimate knowledge. They had thousands of years of history. Whereas like, I ask them what they thought about, like, I don't know,
Belgium.
Belgium. Or you say a country like Kazakhstan, they just have no real interaction with. They're probably going to be like, yeah, sure, fine. Where's Kazakhstan? They just have no sense of, whereas the presidency, everyone knows where the presidency's at. They can point the president up on their mental map.
That's fair.
And so I think that's why it gets so much attention and so much everything, is because it's, and why it causes division, is because it's one of the points where our lived differences, we connect to a shared consciousness, but like our differences come there as well. And we need to, I think, one of the solutions that I think is to create more points of shared consciousness away from these grand things. And one of the values I think of like rock music in the 60s, for example, was that it was like a shared consciousness for a lot of people that was mostly positive emotion. And that's why like Bob Dylan stuff had so much resonance, because it was mostly positive in a shared consciousness, and it was a song. It didn't hold the same weight of expectation that the presidency does. And so I think that's one of the beautiful things why food connects people so much. And people always talk about food connecting.
Because it's one of those most common experiences. Yeah,
but it also doesn't hold so much weight where like you can dislike a cuisine, but you're not going to like try and kill someone because you don't like curry.
I hope not.
I mean, yeah.
No. I hope not. Yeah. Shit.
But you get the point. Although I would argue that there have been wars in India over food. That's just why Indian cuisine culture is incredible, because it's like, think about a culture where like literally people are having wars and like fighting and killing people over like what you eat.
Like, I mean, yeah.
I'm not saying it's a good thing or bad thing, but I'm just saying it's like it's one of the. Yeah, but I guess it derails.
Of those things where like in India at least we're talking in a very abstract, alienated way of this, but it's like, I think the reason why vegetarianism can turn into such a loaded topic in India, I think, is like because it literally is a common experience.
Yeah.
And then when there's a conflict between another group, it may not even necessarily be like those struggles of conquest, right? It might just even be like, especially now when it's supposed to be a secular state, but I'm trying to speak in abstract about communal violence between Hindus and Muslims, right? Oftentimes, vegetarianism is like the wedge issue, especially among upper caste Hindus. And it's like, well, they eat beef. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it kind of symbolizes something.
And it's not even like, it doesn't even turn into a question of like, Oh, I'm gonna get canceled by Indian viewers. God, please forgive me. Yeah. But
I mean, we can turn from this if you feel like, because I definitely don't know enough. I was just pointing out that, like, I was trying to point that I was like, Indian food culture is one of the most rich and diverse.
It's very diverse. It's
showcasing the fact that, like, they care so much about, like, the ingredients that they're willing to go to. Because I don't know any Italians. I mean, maybe some Italians who could people over, like, ingredients, but, like,
I mean, if there's no garlic in it, like, that's a vendetta right there.
Yeah, so it's like, it's one of those points where it's like food, I think it's finding points. And I think because they hold less weight, they need more of them in a way. But it's like, for me, like, yeah, like, when I think of, like, comfort food, I now think of a warm bowl of ramen.
And it's funny you brought that example up, not to derail you again, but it's like, when you talk about that ingredient more, right, people will cite their faith as the reason why they're having that, like, fight. And it's like, for Hinduism, it's like, well, cows are sacred. And then in Islam, it's like, what are you talking about? We always ate this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the question of faith thing is, like, turn out of the window, and you don't even, like, question that thing of, like, well, damn, if those were my assumptions about reality that were handed down for me from my ancestors, I would assume this was normal too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reconciliation. It just turns straight into conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is probably something I'm going to have to really sit and ruminate on, is how do these symbols transform in their manifestation? How can they be manipulated?
Yeah.
And it's not just linguistics and argument strategies. Sometimes it even is just, I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too mystic and too abstract here, but
I think when it comes to moments of connection, I think the reason food and things like that work is that it's something we want with music. It's
right.
These things that are very deep to humans. It's that, the way food is a shared consciousness in a way. And so it's again, it's like where you feel like your shared consciousness is being your, I feel like maybe I just had this thought and part, so it's going to be very unfully formed, but it's that, like, you feel like we all have a little piece of the pie of a human shared consciousness. And when you feel like your culture isn't accepted, or even when you feel like the way you've seen things and then they're like, oh, that's different, you feel like that could be an affront to your little slice of that shared consciousness pie. Like, you're getting left out. I think that's where a lot of "you will not replace us" stuff comes from, is there's a feeling that, like, that shared consciousness, there's a Simpsons thing where, like, the Simpsons, where they were like, I used to be with it, I knew what it was, and I loved it, and it was cool, and now I'm not with it anymore, and now I hate it. And it's literally just the old man yells at clouds. It's that, like, that's not the right quote from the clip, you should look it up, like, the old man, I used to be with it, but it's like, and this guy, Adam Neely, said, if you're older, what happens with old people is they hate young culture, because they used to be with it, and he's like, you don't actually hate it, you just don't know who you are anymore.
Right.
And I think that's the thing, that's what it comes into, is like, you think you know who you are, and then these things come in and say, oh, wait, I've been told my whole life beef is, you know, sacred or acceptable, and now I'm being told maybe it's not. And it's just a sense of, like, well, who am I? That question comes up, and when that question comes up, that cognizance gets hit real quick.
So is everyone always having an existential crisis at every moment?
Yeah, and we're all entitled to our own.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
And I think it's just appreciating, you know, those that we all have. I think it's the appreciation of the fact that that's the truth, rather than trying to find a solution. It's appreciating the question and letting, just living with through the question, and just appreciating that, like, there's something that reminds me of a lot of things. There's two quotes that reminds me of two of my favorite things. One's not a quote, one's just a concept. So in French, the way they say, so when we say translation, this is tangential, but I think it's to the general point of, like, we say you translate from English to French. They say you translate from English towards French. They acknowledge you never actually get there.
Mm.
You just go towards. And I think if we can appreciate that we're never going to get there, we're never really, even with our wife or our children or our husbands or whoever, you're never going to really get there. But it's the act of going towards together that I think is really where we need to aim as, like, a foundation of our society and all these sort of things. And to the point of ever getting there is a quote about the shakuhachi, which is a Japanese flute. And they have a quote that says, it takes a lifetime to learn, so the earlier you start, the longer it takes.
I think you're right. Something does give me, like, a bit of pause about that idea, that maybe it might just be a personal thing, but it's almost like we can't expect to ever achieve that final perfection. We can't expect to achieve one-to-one synced up absolute understanding of what someone communicates to us.
It's communicative samsara, I think, right? Is it samsara, the suffering one?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
The Buddhist of, like, real life is suffering, like, there's always suffering and striving. It's like that's communicative in a way.
I guess. And it's like, but it's like, it will never be fully done. And maybe that's okay. And I'm not sure why I even feel this pressure to feel like it should be absolute. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
See, we're just proving the concept in real time, but this is like...
Yeah, well, I think, this is meta, I think that's what scares some people about like AI, is like, what if we actually had like computers... Although, there's a guy named CJJX who made it, who's a great video essayer, who made a 2.5-hour response to Bo Burnham on his song with Jeff Bezos and Inside, which is, if you haven't seen it, please watch. But he basically talked about how like our phones are like microchips in our brains already because they affect our chemistry so much. But it's like, that might scare people, is like, would it cease to be human when we officially can link our brains 100% through the computers?
And that's what I'm saying, is we abstract so much information away from our heads and other people's heads so much that that's a form of technology in itself, is being able to pull an idea out of your head and transmit it into something else.
Brain is the first computer.
Yeah, communication is the first technology. Speaking literally probably was, I guess. Mm-hmm. But... it doesn't even matter if we, like, I personally find the whole transhuman stuff a little weird. I don't mm-hmm. like it, but in some sense, we're still physically set up to forage for berries. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But the way we live now is exchanging far more information on a minute-by-minute basis and expected to process it and understand it and accept it all at once at a pace and at an amount that our early human ancestors couldn't fathom.
Mm-hmm. And I don't even think we can fathom it, really.
Yeah, that's what I think is. I think we might have gone a little too quick. We might have accelerated the arc of human technological mm-hmm. progress just too quick. And because it's being exacerbated by the profit motive, by that mm-hmm. algorithmic logic of neoliberalism to an extent, right? It's getting out of hand. It's expecting things of people that I think are not realistic, whether it's the amount of labor they put in, whether it's the amount of stress we put people under, how we expect them to get through the day without any support, whether it's the absolute hole we've dug for ourselves ecologically mm-hmm. and that we're really choosing to ignore, or at least the people with their hands on the wheel are choosing to ignore, whether it's that increased sense of personal anguish and personal mm-hmm. pain that people are feeling every day and don't necessarily know how to communicate at times, or don't have anyone they can communicate it to. And I'm not just saying therapy. I'm even just mm-hmm. talking about like social participation in things like social clubs, unions, community organizations is at a low. It's mm-hmm. at a low point. People are making less friends. There's an epidemic of loneliness in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we, though... like, this came about as us trying to solve other problems. Do you think...
with no holistic vision, possibly.
Not just that. That's true, but do you think that then this will then be the problem that we now strive to solve? And humanity, when we focus on a specific problem, actually is okay at solving those problems.
Right. I just think we've been operating on bad assumptions, particularly because of how power has been distributed. And whether you take anti-capitalist rhetoric, whether you take socialist and communist rhetoric, whether you take anarchist rhetoric, is kind of beyond me at this point. But the way I'm seeing it is the focus of the people with their hand on the wheel has been maximizing profit for their owners, for their bosses, for their shareholders, to the point that externalities don't even get priced in. And there's this idea in just purely capitalist logic, like, well, what if you cost it in? That doesn't change the fact that this is still an extractive relationship we have with nature. This is an extractive relationship we have with labor. In a sense, no one has gotten to choose for themselves what is the world they want to live in. And maybe that's too big of a question to ask any human being. What's the world you want to live in? But the collective project of humanity has never been taken into consideration. It's just these are the guys who had their hand on the wheel. Well, this is where they're choosing to chart it.
Do you think that it has, though, and that's a response to that? Because, I mean, the Nazis definitely thought about the collective vision of humanity and the direction of humanity. And do you think it's a response
to... It was to one they wanted to impose on people.
Yeah, but I agree. But it's still... The question has been dealt with before, and I think the way it's been dealt with it has been so... I don't know, what's the worst version of horrible, that we have now, at least culturally, even if maybe we're, I know, we're 80 years past the Holocaust, but it's like, we're, not that we're past atrocities, but just like, that was the first global version of it, you could argue. Like
in some sense, yeah.
Or maybe the first, but one of the first, whereas like now we've been doing it in a small situation, like how do I want, you know, the United States to look? Like what should be the collective human endeavor, like goal of the United States. It's so we don't know. It's what of our city, or of our street, or of our town. Like it's something we've always done. It's just like now is the one of the first times ever that we've thought about humanity as a literal global context.
But we thought about it as a global context, and I don't know the way. I need to again maybe come up with more theoretical backing for what I'm trying to say. Maybe I need to find better language for it. But the sense of community that I want to feel, or the sense of community that I think is the right thing we should all feel for one another, is sorely lacking in all of this. Yeah. And how do you get there?
Yeah, I think, I actually think that that is the central focus of most of my work I do now.
Okay.
Like creative work. Because while capitalism, there's all the critiques of the economic models, and there's a bunch of them. To me, it's more like how, to me, a lot of relationships, at least, have been, or they've been perceived as, like, we view, like, our dating life as extractive capitalism. What can you do for me? Look at the dating app, even. It's, like, prove your worth. You know, the question, what do you do, is not even, like, it means how do you, what's your value, what's your profit to margin, how much money do you make? And even if they don't mean it that way, it's still, you still have to choose to not mean it that way. It's the paradigm of everything where it's like,
it's in the background, it's in the air, basically. Yeah,
and it's the oxygen you have to, it's the poison, the oxygen, but you got to breathe anyways.
Right.
And so for me, the question to me that I've asked is, I can't deal with this as a social issue. Like, I mean, not social, I can't deal with this as a societal-wide issue. I'm one person, you know. I think it's a point where every person who is in the oppressing group, if you will, has to come to and realize that, like,
right,
I'm not going to solve it. I'm a white dude. I'm not going to solve racism. I'm a guy. I'm not. We're not going
to. Well, you can be part of the movement.
But that's what I'm saying, is that that's what I was trying to get to.
Yeah,
like, you have to find out that, like, you're not solving the whole thing, but the way you go about it and the way you work around with everyone around you and then push people around you, that is part of it. Like, you can only do a part. You can only be a cog in the machine, but you then have to ask yourself, how are you going to be in that machine? And you have to come to the realization that we create the world that creates us. That if you can make, if you feel like, I want people around me who are more, less extractive in our ways of viewing people, that take the time. Like, I tell my friends a lot of time who are in their 20s, I'm like, they're busy all the time. I'm like, you have no children. Some of them live at home. I'm like, how are you busy?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you doing? Like, take time, enjoy life, go on trips, you know, meditate, like, do what you want to do, whatever, you know, pick your thing you want to do. But it's like,
right,
try and take yourself away from this extractive way of viewing the world, of this like capitalist opportunity cost way of viewing the world, even though opportunity cost to think to some degree that is true, but just this kind of way of viewing, like letting things be a lot more, and then kind of taking yourself out of that system. Because realistically speaking, if we take up, while they might have the wheel, if we start taking apart the car, eventually you just end up with a wheel that doesn't drive anything. And I think our role is to start taking apart our little parts of that car and decenter us from that car, but doing it in a collective way that is social, that is legal as well. Like, it can't just be like, I'm going to run away from society, I'm going to do my thing, F everyone. You do have to be ingrained in society to then change that society, but you have to, it's not really, I'm having trouble forming the full point.
You have to participate it. It's what, it's that
change
meme.
Change the rules of participation, I think.
Well, there's that, and also there's that meme that comes to mind of like, oh, you hate capitalism, but you use an iPhone. It's like,
yeah,
in a
gotta breathe oxygen, even if it's poison.
Or it's like someone made like a parody of that where it was like a feudal peasant saying, we should change society somewhat, and the lord in their castle in the back saying, oh, but yet you participate in feudalism, you must be smart. And it's mm-hmm. like, you don't get any brownie points, I guess, from not participating in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't fully fetishize your guilt about how monstrous it can be. You don't have a choice but to participate in mm-hmm. it sometimes, because either you don't know better, or, let's face it, you don't get any points for suffering intentionally. Mm-hmm. Unless you want to be austere in like a genuine sense,
mm-hmm.
it's not worth doing. But there's some truth, I feel, in like a more simple, less wantonly extractive or consumerist way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something worth recognizing other people's humanity and recognizing the effort they put in every day.
Mm-hmm.
That necessary to appreciating one another.
The more I think that you reshape your perspectives of value. So on a personal level, I'm trying to recalibrate my perception of my zero. So you know, I'm sure you're aware of the cap. Like if your new zero, if you make 50k a year, that's your new zero. You make 70k, 70k becomes your new zero. Now if you make less, you psychologically feel like you're making less than zero mm-hmm. in a way. Or like you also create your life where like you have a certain home that you need to make 100K to pay off or whatever.
Right.
Now you have 70K. Now you're struggling. Whereas when you're at 40K, if someone said you're going to make 70K, you'd be like, oh, yeah, because you're new zero. And so for me personally, I'm trying to fulfill my needs in terms of like my food, water, healthcare, all things as close to $0 as possible.
Mm.
Well, not being stupid, like I do put money away in retirement and things like that. Because like I said, like I might critique the system, but I'm not going to just not put money away for retirement. It's that kind of paradox where like you need to kind of hedge your bets because like you can't do anything if you're dead. You can't help a system if you're dead.
Right,
you
do. And that's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, something that I do feel not necessarily guilty, but just kind of horrified by is the monstrous levels of waste and alienation
mm-hmm.
of the people who toil within it. That's something that does, like, bring me a certain sense of existential dread, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's what... And it should push you to, you know, try to be a little more independent of it, or try to not participate in the really wasteful aspects of it.
And I think, you know, as much as I lament some pithy aphorisms, you know, being the change you want to see in the world doesn't change the world, but it will change your individual world.
Yeah.
Like, if you are someone who cares more about your environment and recycles, or not recycles more because that doesn't really do anything. Like,
hard it's really fucked up how that worked out.
I hate to surprise anyone, recycling doesn't really do anything. Unless you're doing your personal recycling, isn't like you're like using your used clothes as like for compost. Like that individual personal recycling of your own clothes system does help. Putting things in a recycling bin does very little. It mm-hmm. can it does help a tiny bit, but the perspective of it means that people buy it. Actually, side note, it has what's called the rebound effect. I'm sure you're aware of this. Where like once you think plastic can be recycled, you're more likely to buy plastic. So you actually buy more plastic, and you can't recycle all of it. So actually, there ends up being more plastic in the landfills.
And that's like what I find in opposition to, or this is what I'm fundamentally opposed to, is anything that doesn't threaten the hegemony of the consumer system. Any solution that's offered to people where it's like, no, you can still buy.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you want to eat healthy food, but you want to have the convenience of like not having to grow any of it or prepare a lot of it.
You want cake to have the same nutrients as broccoli.
In that sense, right? So it's like, oh, I'll just buy organic. That doesn't change anything. Or it's like, oh, I can still buy all this stuff, but I'll just recycle it so it's not sitting in a landfill. But it's like, and unfortunately, it's not working out the way we planned it would because this is still governed by profit incentives and not... the just principle of like this is wasteful, we shouldn't do it.
But I think that again gets to the point of like there's a shared human consciousness, but there's also like our shared world consciousness of like me and you. Like if I do something, you're more likely to take that up. And so like while I might not change the world, be the change in the world that I see, the point I made earlier, I'm really saying the same thing, was like you can change your individual world, and that's the most you can do, quite frankly.
And try to connect with
people. And like you're gonna, if you are a good friend who, you know, goes to marches all the time, or you do social causes, or you donate, like if you do that and your friends see you doing that and they care about you, there are just studies that have shown that they are more likely to do that thing too. And then, like for me, it was one of the issues that I came up with where I was like, I came home from Japan And I heard someone make a racist comment, and I was like, oh my god, people do that still. Because when I was in Japan, I didn't understand when they were making the comments. I didn't speak Japanese well enough to know that.
Right.
So, like, the world I lived in, my world was so much more progressive. It was people from all different cultures and walks of life. I was a token white guy a lot of times, and, like, in a non-white country, I was a minority while being a token white guy, like, in a country. And not saying that's, not to make, that's not like a, we can talk about that later, but, like,
it's a fun thing to say. Yeah, it's very funny. Yeah, I will say.
But basically, it's this thing where, like, you, the world you live in is crafted by you. You create, like the point I made earlier, where you create the world you live in that creates you. So, like, create friends who, you know, you can, you, you do create your friends. And, but if, but not in that, you shouldn't do it in a way that's, which I know sounds a bit wild.
No, I just had an insane idea.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, go for it.
Our experiences give our perception of reality context.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, because things can be random, we can't even take our context for granted at times. Fuck.
Yeah, you don't ever know your own context.
Exactly.
Which I think is, I find, very comforting and warm.
But that is also the phenomenon of greenhouse gaslighting. You know what I mean? Where you're trapped in your bubble so well that it just kind of accelerates the process of
just throwing stones in your own glass house.
Yeah, yeah. And you're, like, fully alienated at that point. That you just don't see, like, the world around you. Fuck.
Yeah. But I think that, again, you're only could ever do that. Because we do still have
our without human connection, you could only ever do that.
I think even with human connection, you just, your bubble gets a bit bigger.
Let's make it the biggest bubble possible then. Shit.
That, I think that
there
is
we
the
go.
Solution.
There we go.
I think personally, that's from my personal take, that is kind of the life I've lived. I mean, you know, I've been around, like, that's
right.
I'm basically trying to expand my bubble. Like, I don't just travel to places for a week. I go there and live there for a year. Like, I want a deep connection to that place where when something happens there, like, I'm moved. Because it reminds me of people and cultures. Like, when I eat, when I think about, like, food I want to eat before I die, a lot of it is, like, a certain ramen spot in a certain town with a certain guy serving it, because I have that connection there.
Right.
And it's, like, that's what I'm seeking. And I think if we all sought that in our own little ways, we would make our own spider web. But we're not one spider. We're a billion tiny spiders building one giant web.
Well, that's the perfect visual for Halloween. God damn.
Yeah. So I think ultimately, yeah, like, change your friends. Not like saying to try and change them, but just, like, trust that they will love you for your truth, and then therefore you don't have to hate yourself for your lie. But, like,
that's deep. That's deep.
Yeah. But I think it's true. Like, if you want to be a change, be a change. Be different. Be what you want to do. Disconnect yourself from, like, the notions of capital as much as you can, obviously. Then, like, you can't ever fully disconnect, but I don't think you fully should. Like, I think if you fully disconnect, then you lose your ability to understand enough. It's like an old person who doesn't understand culture at all. You become the old person yelling at clouds. So you do it to some degree. You have to. It's not a bad thing if you make a bit of money, if you, you know, have your money to pay your bills, because that's what you can do, because it also helps inform you how you choose to now seek to change that system. Because you can't change a system if you don't even know you're swimming in water.
Yeah, and it's like, I think a lot of people too, when they engage this liberal form of, it's almost like they're trying to launder their guilt for being on the receiving end. But it's like, you can still be on the side of more privilege or the side of the oppressive benefit and still recognize this is a wrong system. And it should be less about laundering your guilt or laundering your leg up in this and saying that it's wrong that this happens in the first place. It's wrong that this person suffers. It's wrong that I benefit.
Yeah.
That's far more powerful.
Yeah. A little sign. I just thought of, like, you know, like a laundromat. And I just thought, like, white people go in with their white clothes and get it clean. That's like, I had that image there. But, like, yeah, I agree. I think that's the role of everyone with, because everyone has their own personal privilege. I mean, we talked about this where I've been in a room with people of color, and I'm the only person with a mental disorder, and all of a sudden I'm like, how am I the minority here? It's like this weird situation where, like, if you think you're never, like, or the Black Panther Party, where they were, but the men were preaching for black power, were also, like, having very sexist views of women, it's like, you can use your, in a weird way, privilege as a benefit, because you, it's really, it hits you harder, but when you don't have anything to hide behind, you just have to face it, and it becomes a more existential crisis, and I think, ultimately, facing it is your, part of your role.
And that's also something that is then becomes fascinating about how this all intersects, because it's like, how much more marginally sexist were the Black Panthers of that time compared to white men of that time? Like, were they somehow more sexist as a result? Because it's at these points that when we challenge one contradiction, there's this immediate desire to expose the person trying to bring it up as a hypocrite in some sense. Mm-hmm. And in sometimes it's kind of necessary to do that because some people are just wrong. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the Black Panthers, they had a good point. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And in context, we should always try to call out those examples of those multiple layers of change that need to happen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Where we all need to accept the infinite diversity of human experiences. Yeah. But, you know, the fact that we should still be having a shared consciousness in some sense.
I mean, Gandhi had sexist views that doesn't like diminish that he did other good work. You know, I mean, he said he was abusive to his wife when he was younger. And that doesn't mean that when he's 60, he's not doing meaningful work. I don't know if that's exactly what you kind of meant, but
That's not exactly what, but I mean, it's even less of like, oh, separate the art from the artist. I'm talking more about like when we look back at these certain examples, because one, like, I have like a personal thing of like, why is it that certain marginalized groups are called out for their sexism uniquely, mm-hmm. when, as we understand it, it's more universal than it is isolated among certain groups, right? Mm-hmm. But so there's that side of it. And then there's also the fact of like, if such contradictions do arise, then that is one of those things that I guess comes back to our overall theme. It's not really a point I'm making, I guess. Yeah. It's just more of like I'm trying to tie it together.
People contain multitudes, and therefore the systems they create will contain multitudes, and it's just multitudes all the way down. And, you know, I think when, you know, the point, I guess, of like critiquing people at the Black Panther Party of like they had these sex-twos is like two points. One, making mistakes doesn't make you a bad person. It just makes you a person. Yeah. So like a group making mistakes doesn't make it a bad group. It just makes it a group. And two, like what I always say is it a period or is it a comma or semicolon colon? I should know this because I did languages, but I can't remember one. Where someone says like this happens all the time with like I'll talk to middle-aged white guys.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, well, they talk about all white people are racist, and like all people are racist. That ends with a period. It doesn't go, well, if all people are racist, what are my biases? It's not the comma, it's the period. And I think that's where it comes down to with like why people of color, for example, critique for their sexism uniquely, is because they're doing it with see how bad they are, period. They're not saying it's like, well, the Black Panther already had these sexist perspectives and things that not all of them, obviously, it wasn't the whole party, but they definitely existed there. But it's because of the nuance. There's a comma after that. There's deep thought.
There should always be a comma then.
But I think a lot of these things, why they come out, is because they're meant to be a period. Stop talking to me. Don't try and change the system. Let me go on my day. Or just, I don't want to deal with this. Whatever reason they have, that's something I have to ask myself. Are you putting a period there, or are you putting a comma? Or, again, like the colon, semicolon, whatever you want to put. And that's something I think when you look at why these things happen, I think it doesn't answer all of it, but I think it helps shed some clarity as the purpose.
Right.
You know, are they trying to just make a statement, this is why, goodbye, or are they trying to actually engage? And usually you'll find that they're just trying to push stuff away, make a period, make this go away, have the sentence leave. And not try and engage more deeply, because that would require them to really come face to face with their own cognitive dissonances.
Exactly.
Where they can say all people are racist, but not think that means white people when they're saying that phrase.
And that's where the study of history becomes very useful, mm-hmm. then, because events happen regardless of our context for them. And then when we try to assign context to something, that is us putting a period on it, I guess. Mm-hmm. And those are where we should, you know, really get a chance to question things, where we really get a chance to understand the process of history less than the kind of great man struggles that we popularly understand history through.
Ubermensch, yeah.
Yeah. And, wow, we've been at this for like an hour 23 at this point.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3. But I think, I don't know, some people might call this episode is more like navel gazing and kind of just abstract or really like verbose.
Deep in navel gazing.
And it's like, I don't necessarily have the conceptual framework I wish I did to kind of explain some of this. And I'm also willing.
This is the first point. The words.
And I'm highly willing to admit where I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't profess to know everything. I don't profess to even be like, this is my body of knowledge, respected or else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to, I guess.
Always leave space in your bookshelf.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is like, how that space got there, why that space is the way it is, it kind of happened randomly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to account for it as gracefully and as kindly as I can to everyone around me. So
I think that's, if not the meaning of life, it's least tangential to it.
Right, right. And it's, you know, it's through interaction that we recognize one another's humanity. And I think mm-hmm. that's special. I think that's sacred. And I think that's what I want to take forward with me.
Yeah.
Through life.
Yeah. And I think you then bring that to other people. The things you have within yourself are that which you give other people. So yeah. If you take that desire for love and compassion, like, other people will then feel that and hopefully internalize that as well. And I think that's all you can really do. And maybe try and make some fart jokes along the way. And
Then,
you know, I think that's basically it. Like, it's love and fart jokes. I mean, really, that's summing it up right there. In a slightly self-ironic douchebaggy way. but yeah, I think that, like, yeah, you gotta be, yeah, that's about it, that's about all.
Yeah, we were all over the place, but yeah. You know, that's dialectics.
We both have ADHD, so that's expected.
Yeah, I'm not even gonna edit this, I'm just gonna upload this raw dogged, but I think this was a good discussion. It opened my eyes in what I'm supposed to feel. Maybe I'll find a better conceptual framework for all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great to finally have you on. Do you have anything you want to plug or anything for folks to follow?
Nah, their hearts.
Follow your heart.
There we go.
A rare first. But yeah, thanks again for tuning in, dear listener. This has been another episode of Greenhouse Gaslighting. I'm your host, Adi. You can follow us on Twitter at @podgreenhouse. You can follow me on Twitter at Fibonacci Sniper. The other links are in the description. You know the drill. Till next time, signing out. Take care, folks.